Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Pretty Lies and Alibis. Let's seek the truth and travel the long road to justice together. But you know, alibiers, welcome to another episode of Pretty Lies and Alibis. I'm Gigi. This episode and probably the rest may be a little echoey because I've changed places where I'm staying, and this is very open and tall ceilings and everything's hard. So I'm going to try to clean it up a little bit so it's not quite so echoey, but it's just how it rolls. So thanks to everybody who donated. I've still got to get a list together. I've been crazy busy. I was delayed yesterday in Dallas for about 4 hours and did not get settled into this new place until after 2 a.m. and had to get up at 5. So I'm going to be calling it early tonight, so I will get the list together. I do appreciate your generosity, though. Music fact of the day. This surprised me. The Lumineers song, Ho Hey. People think it's a love song, but it was not written to be a love song. It was more about the myth of New York. You go there, you're a musician, you're going to make it big, and it's more about a lost dream. And the writer said that it kind of blows him away that people play at weddings, but also it's pretty cool that people find beauty in what the original meaning was supposed to be. So we are going to jump right in. It was a pretty explosive day of testimony, I think, in this case. The biggest piece for me so far connecting Lori to all this came when they called Keely Coleman to the stand. She is a senior DNA analyst. And in May of 2022, her lab received 3 DNA profiles, one from Tylee, Lori, and Melanie Gibb, as well as a hair that was attached to a piece of duct tape. She explains how they processed the hair for testing, and because there was biological material present with the decomposition of JJ's body, they had to wash the hair, and she talks all through the steps that they go through to get it tested and to get that DNA profile extracted. So to make a long story short, bombshell, big bombshell, that hair sample belonged to Lori Vallow, and it was a really quick direct exam. That's all they needed to get out. Mr. Thomas got up for cross-exam, and he goes through her education. He does that with every witness, asks about like training that they do just yearly to keep their credentials up and that kind of thing. By the way, Lori really didn't have much reaction to being named that was her hair. I'm sure she knew in advance, but still, she just didn't look like it bothered her at all. So Mr. Thomas talks about 99.9% of human DNA, we all share the same stuff. I think we share like 90-something% with a banana too. So that's kind of crazy. But the human, there's something called a loci. And essentially a loci is a genetic street address of where that particular DNA is located. The FBI requires 20 loci for their samples, and their lab requires 3. And each lab has their own minimal threshold of how many loci they need to test. It was really technical testimony, but ultimately Mr. Thomas, he points out that she's 13 loci short of what the FBI would require for their, I guess, standards. He just says 17 out of the 20 that the FBI requires are missing. So Rob Wood came back up for redirect, and he asked if she tested these samples against known profiles. And she said, of course, it was Tylee, Lori, and Melanie Gibb. And this was only a partial profile. This is very, very common to use a partial profile to determine whose sample that was, as with this case. So they go back through how it was found. It was found on duct tape in the presence of that decomposition fluid, and they washed the sample. Now, Lori was writing on her paper at this point, and she was kind of laughing when she was talking to Mr. Thomas. It's common to rely on a partial profile, and it happens very regularly. That was something Mr. Thomas brought up on cross. Ultimately, if you have a hat and you put in 71 billion pieces of paper, only one of those would have Lori's name on it. That's how sure they are that this strand of hair belonged to Lori. And we took a really early morning break for the defense to look over a few things. And the next witness was Ricky Wright. He was a special agent with the FBI. He's now a contract special investigator. And we go through his education. And so he became involved in the case on November 27th, 2019, when he was contacted by Lieutenant Rumball from Rexburg about JJ being missing. And the FBI gets involved when children are missing who are under 12 years of age and is under some suspicious circumstances. At this time, by the way, only JJ was known to be missing, not Tylee. Then they learned Tylee was missing. Initially, he said they thought she was with family in Arizona. And when they contacted family in Arizona and nobody had seen Tylee, then she was considered missing as well. At this time, Tammy Daybell's death, when he got involved, it was being investigated as well as the murder of Charles Vallow. They were also looking into the attempted murder of Brandon Boudreaux. He was the one that met with Ian Pawlowski, who we know is Melanise's husband. He talked to Ian at the Rexburg Police Department. And after speaking with Ian, the concern for the safety of the kids increased to him. They asked him to record conversation he was a party to, and he agreed. We know that Ian wore, it was like a thumb drive looking thing that he was given. And anytime there could have been something brought up about the location of the kids, he was supposed to have that ready to record. Those recordings would be given to investigators and then extracted and entered into custody. So he asked for additional assistance in looking at location data associated with Alex Cox's devices by the FBI team who specialized in phone pings. And the dates they focused on were when the children were last seen. The witness requested that he provide everything from the month of September 2019 and later on the month of October. And so they brought in a PowerPoint about these findings. And Mr. Thomas, he asked some questions about how he prepared this PowerPoint, and he said that he worked with it just last night with the prosecutors. And Mr. Thomas asked, did they tell you anything they need to be in your report or on this PowerPoint due to holes in their cases? And the witness says this was actually to assist him with his testimony. And he's asked if anything anyone has testified to came up last night while they were working on this, and he says no. So Mr. Thomas had no objection. So the phone first that they were looking at, the Gmail account, was that homerjmaximus@gmail.com, and they put all that up on the screen. On September 1st, 2019, that was the first ping in the Rexburg area for this phone for Alex, and it was in the evening. That first ping actually came from St. George, Utah, and the device spent its evenings at the townhouse from Unit 175. That is Lori's townhouse. And then on September the 5th, the phone started staying in Unit 107, which was Alex's townhouse. Then they found the photos of Tylee, JJ, and Alex in Yellowstone. Up until then, they did not know what happened to Tylee after Yellowstone. If you followed this case from the very beginning, a lot of us thought something happened to her and she was disposed of in Yellowstone. So let's look at the 8th. This is when they go to Yellowstone National Park, and this is also the last day Tylee is alive. And at 11:52 a.m., he is at a gas station. 1:29 p.m., they are at the entrance of Yellowstone National Park. From 2:50 to 2:57, they're in the area where Old Faithful is. From 3:04 to 3:22 p.m., they were in the Old Faithful Lodge cafeteria. 3:42 to 4:04 p.m., they're at the Old Faithful Rim. That last photo, by the way, was taken at 3:49 p.m., the ones we've all seen of JJ and Tylee, and then JJ, Tylee, and Alex. There's also a selfie with Lori and JJ in that as well. Then from 4:15 to 4:27, they are in the Old Faithful parking lot. They're showing overhead photos with little dots of the progression of the day. You couldn't see the times from where I was sitting, but it just like a Google map that shows those little red dots. So from 5:12 until 6:40 p.m., they're traveling through the park, and they leave the park at 6:40. Between 6:45 and 7:02 p.m., on the last night Tylee was alive, they are at a Buckaroo Bill's barbecue. The jury was super focused on this PowerPoint, by the way. They focused in on the boardwalk area after those photos of JJ, Tylee, and Alex were found on Lori's iCloud account. It was that Lori 4 style at the Old Faithful geyser. They show that photo of Tylee, JJ, and Alex that was taken at 3:49 p.m. that day. Then they show an overhead view of Yellowstone from where they started in Rexburg up to Yellowstone and back home. He said it didn't seem there was any pause from their travels or any stops in unpopulated areas, and the vehicle maintained its speed. So in other words, I think at this point, they kind of knew Tylee was likely not in Yellowstone. That was kind of how I read into it, at least. So from 8:37 p.m. to 9:35 p.m., Alex's phone is pinged at the townhomes. 9:43 to 9:53, a Mavericks gas station. Then from 10:44 to 11:15, the phone is in Lori's apartment. Then at 11:44, it's back in Alex's townhomes. Now we go into September the 9th, the morning into when we think Tylee was murdered. There were three data points. From 2:42 a.m. until 3:37 a.m., he was in Lori's townhouse within a 4-meter radius. So we know he was right in those townhomes. Then 4:37 a.m., 4:39 a.m., 4:41 a.m., 5:14, 6:47, and 8:49. He's pinged at his townhome, and there was an 8 to 37 meter radius of where he could have been. So it looks to me, unfortunately, like sometime between 2:42 a.m. and 3:37, if Tylee was in fact killed in those townhomes, that's likely about when it happened in that time frame. What caught his attention was that it was normal for Alex's phone to be in Lori's apartment from about 8 at night until midnight, and then he would go to his townhouse and stay the rest of the night. So it was unusual for Alex's phone to be pinged in her apartment in the middle of the night. They show an overhead photo of the distance between Lori and Alex's townhomes, and it's about 80 meters, so it's not far at all. Lori was paying hyper attention to this witness, by the way. So the morning of the night at 9 a.m., Alex leaves the townhomes. By 9:15, he arrives at Chad's residence. From 9:15 until 11:45 a.m., he is at Chad's. This is likely when, trigger warning, Tylee was being dismembered, and I'm assuming maybe they started that fire pit up. From 11:15 to 11:45, that's when we think the dismemberment and the burial was taking place. At 9:21 a.m., he was behind the residence within 6 meters. Then at 9:22 a.m., he was by the gate on the northwest corner of the property. So you have a driveway that you can drive into their house, but then kind of kitty corner in the back field, there is a gate there that will let you kind of into the back of the property, which I did not know about, and I thought that was interesting. At 10:39, he was behind the residence in that area where the pet cemetery is. There's a 43-meter radius. And then at 10:57, again, behind that residence, 5 meters. At 11:45 a.m., Alex leaves Chad's residence. And then at 11:52, nothing says I'm hungry after murdering and dismembering my niece like he goes to Del Taco. Really, y'all, he does. They have a slide showing all the data points. I mean, it is right on top of where they found Tylee's remains. It's amazing what technology can do, y'all. Just because it was the same for JJ. It showed exactly where they were. I can't imagine when they got this back and were able to put it into the software and you see these two places on the day after they know both kids were last seen. I can't imagine. They probably felt like, wow, okay, this is a huge, huge break because it's suspicious, right? And then at 9:21, actually, that morning, that was the first data point near the pet cemetery. That was a 6-meter radius. That alternate entrance Like we said, it allows vehicles to get to the back part of the property. The witness says that several devices were gathered in this case, and then they show the text from Chad to Tammy at 11:52 a.m., and that was taken from a device that they got during that search warrant at Chad's in January of 2020. And it's the one, well, I've had an interesting morning. I felt I should burn all the limb debris by the fire pit before it got soaked by the coming storms. And then it goes on that he shot the raccoon and buried it in the pet cemetery. And this really got investigators' attention. They didn't understand the significance of why Alex was there at this time, but coupled with that text Chad sent Tammy, it showed he was on the property at the same time Alex was. Then all that became part of the investigation. An additional search warrant for Chad's property was obtained after the text from Tammy to Chad was discovered, along with those pings of Alex's phone. And this was when they found the bodies of JJ and Tylee. So let's move to the night JJ was murdered as far as Alex's phone pings. 4:26 to 5:08 p.m., Alex is at Lori's townhome. 5:09 to 5:11, he's at his townhome. 5:12 to 6:45, he's back at Lori's. 6:46 to 8:03 p.m., he is in his townhome. 8:04 to 8:09, he's back at Lori's. And then 8:11 to 8:56, he's back at his townhouse. Now, remember, this is the time when Melanie Gibb and David Warwick were in town, and they were doing that podcast. So I'm trying to figure out at what point, maybe from 8:04 to 8:09, is when David Warwick saw JJ asleep on Alex's shoulder. Because from 8:11 to 8:56, the phone is at Alex's place. Then from 12:11 until 9:41 a.m., it's placed in his townhome. So to me, it seems like JJ was likely murdered sometime between 8:11 and 9:41 a.m. So we know after 8:11 that night is likely when poor little JJ was killed. 9:41 a.m. to 9:55, he's traveling to Chad's. And then 9:55 to 10:12 a.m., he's at Chad's for 17 minutes. 9:56 to 10:02, they're right by that pond where JJ's remains were found. From 10:05 to 10:07, they were at the front door of the residence. At 10:12, he said Alex is heading south away from Chad's residence. Then from 10:22 to 11:14 a.m., Alex is at Lori's townhome. By the way, the pond pings were about 3 to 4 meters of a radius, so it was right there. The front of the house had a larger radius at 68 to 92 meters when he was pinged as being in front of the residence, and that they show the overhead Google Earth that showed those pings right by that pond where JJ's remains were found. So then we move on to some pings at a window tinting shop. So September 23rd, he was there from 1:53 to 1:58. On the 25th, he was at the window tinting shop from 9:02 to 9:03, and then 11:57 to 11:59. They show a photo of that Jeep with the tinted windows and also a receipt for October 1st, 2019 at 1:12 for Los Favoritos, which is in Mesa, Arizona. That's the day before Brandon was shot at. Then on the 18th, 10:18, this is the day before Tammy Daybell is murdered. At 8:05 p.m., he is seen at a Chick-fil-A in Amman, Idaho. We know Tammy died or was murdered overnight between the 18th and the 19th. Now, device purchases for Alex. On September 25th, between 7:03 and 7:18 p.m., there was a visit to Walmart, and he checked out at 7:10 p.m., for a cash purchase of a cell phone. And then also, if we move back to October the 8th, the day before the attempt of Tammy, from 3:01 to 3:37, he's in a Walmart. The receipt was given at 3:25. These were recovered April 10th of 2020. After the search warrant and Alex's death, items were kept by the property management company. Some things were thrown out, some things were kept. They did find two cell phones and turn those over. One was one of those track phones that was bought at Walmart. Now, the whole time I have in my notes, Lori was writing. She wrote a lot today. Then they show the receipt for the phone purchases on the screen. Mr. Thomas is on cross and asks how many receipts he's gotten over the 20 years he's worked with the FBI, and he says a lot. Mr. Thomas wants to know, how does he know this is the actual receipt? And notice that the agent didn't put his initials anywhere on the receipt, and asks if he referenced the store number. And so the agent is looking over his report to see if he put anything identifying that receipt in there as the one he got that day. The agent did put in the store number and phone number associated with the device purchased. Now, Mr. Thomas objects, saying he can't say these are the specific receipts, but Judge Boyce overrules that. The receipts match the location data to Alex. So between September 30th, 2019 and October 3rd, 2019, this is when Alex is traveling to Arizona to try and kill Brandon. They notice deviations in his normal pattern of where he normally is. So on the 30th, from 1:17 to 4:32 p.m., Alex is in his townhome. The same day, the first and the second, that phone stays at Lori's. Then on the third, is back at Alex as well. We know he got back into town. So what we think he did, left his normal phone there at home, took a burner phone down with him because we know there were calls and texts between him and Lori and Chad during that attempt. So let's look at some gun range visits because they sort of line up with important events when people were killed or attempted to be killed. September 3rd, 2019, he goes to the gun range at 145 to 146 just for a minute. Then he goes to Walmart from 205 to 236, and then he's back at that gun range from 259 to 451 p.m. Then on September 26th, he is at the gun range from 4:54 to 6:58 p.m. On the 27th, the next day, the 27th of September, he's at the gun range from 3:54 to 6:45. Then on the 28th, back at the gun range, 3:25 to 5:58. They show an overhead of the gun range with the data points at firing lines going down range. There are different meters as it progresses down the line that he visited. So you start off close, and then as you get farther down, your target is further down the line. So essentially, as he moved down the line, the distances got longer. The device was not over at that short pistol area where those are shot. So on October 7th, there were multiple gun ranges. There were some narrow times he could have just driven by. Maybe they weren't open. But at 12:40 on the 7th, this is 2 days before the attempt on Tammy, at 12:40, he left immediately, came and went. 1:09, Alex was in his apartment for 1 minute. Then from 1:25 to 1:29, he was at the gun range.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Then from 1:50 to 2:16, they have him at the gun range. 2:37 to 2:43, he's at his apartment. Then at 3:03 to 3:24, back at the gun range. I kind of wonder if maybe he went and got more ammo, a different gun or something, because to stay in your apartment for less than 10 minutes, you're just there grabbing something and leaving. So what about the day before Tammy was shot at? 10:28 to 10:29, it shows him at a gun range. Then from 11:07 to 12:29, he is at a gun range. After the attempt on Tammy on the 12th, from 2:57 p.m. to 5:01, he was at a gun range, and he was at the 50-yard distance range of where the target would be. Then on October 13th, from 12:49 to 2:40, he went to the rifle and the pistol range. October 15th, there were two shooting range visits, one from 8:01 to 9:20 a.m. Then at 9:34 to 10:15, he was at Walmart. 10:24 a.m. to 12:16 p.m., he's back at his townhome. From 12:17 to 1:17, he's in Lori's townhome. From 1:41 to 1:56, he's at Chad Daybell's. Then from 4:23 to 6:17, he's at the gun range. So the day that Tammy is shot at, he is at the gun range from 3:54 p.m. to 4:12 p.m. Now, we know there were weapons found in Lori's apartment when everybody split after the welfare check. But Wi-Fi data points from the day of the attempt on Tammy shows Alex in a parking lot, and then he is spread out just inside this gun range building. He was kind of all over in there. So the detective or the agent went to the Sportsman's warehouse to investigate. He got receipts for all the purchases the time the device was there. So there were some purchases that got his attention, some bullfrog rain pants. Those were found in possession of the property manager of the townhomes. They're just plain black rain pants that just repel water. He had some gloves, the kind that you can flip over to cover your fingers or flip back to uncover your fingers. He got a camouflage beanie, a ski mask, because remember on the 911 call, Tammy Daybell said the person was in a ski mask and he bought him a soda. So they show images of what the items looked like. And they also found that Alex had searched for these frog tog pants on his Google account. The pants were the same SKU and size once they were retrieved by investigators from that property manager. And they still had the tags on them, so they matched them to that receipt. So let's look at the attempt on Tammy. At 4:12 p.m., he leaves the Sportsman's warehouse. That's where you can buy things. That's where there's a firing range. From 4:50 to 5:03, he is in the vicinity of the Daybell house. He travels past their house twice. At 4:51, he is located at a parking pullout on the street there, on that same street that they live on. From 5:16 to 11:52 p.m., his phone is at the townhouse, so likely he left it there. Then if we go into that next morning after the attempt, from 12:03 a.m. to 11:28 a.m., his phone is in his apartment. And then they do an overhead view of the Daybell property as well as that street down, showing his movements the day Tammy was shot at. At 4:52 p.m., he pinged 525 yards from the Daybell residence. So there's an irrigation canal right where he was parked. Now, the agent noted that road is narrow. There's no shoulder on it, and it slopes down into a ditch. There's really not a good place to park a car, but there's a pull-off that he points out and said if somebody was going to park a car, it would be right there. And it's, you know, not far from the Daybell residence. The track phone that he bought on October the 8th was actually activated on the 9th at 1 p.m. the day Tammy was shot at. By 7:16, Alex's phone is at the townhouse and stays the night there. And then from 7:13 to 10:30, with the new device, it communicated 10 times with a phone associated with Chad. So that is the window in which she was shot at. So you think maybe he's talking to Tammy, seeing what time she might be home. 10:30, that's the last call. At that point, we know she had already been shot at. They were not able to retrieve those messages between Alex and Chad. So in October, he looked at additional location data for Alex's phone, and he focused on the 16th through the 18th, where the device left Rexburg and went to Las Vegas. It went to the Comfort Inn in Utah on Interstate 15, and then it continued on to Vegas. Now, what's interesting, Lori had taken a flight from Las Vegas on the 17th of October, 2 days before Tammy's murder. So it looks like Lori took Alex's phone with her. So the day before Tammy's murder, we're going into the evening hours of the 18th, right before she's murdered. From 7:58 to 9:32 p.m., he is at a Chick-fil-A in Amman, Idaho. 10:07 to 10:45, he is pinged near an LDS church in the area. Now, there is a gap in the data from 10:45 to 11:53. So at 11:53, Alex travels towards Rexburg. He passes those townhomes, and then he goes to Idaho Falls and stays at a hotel. There's an overhead map, again, showing where that phone lingered, where that church is. It looks like a parking lot, maybe that he was sitting in. The distance from that parking lot to Chad and Tammy's residence was 2.6 miles. So There were three dates in October that Alex's phone went near the Daybell residence. That was on the 9th, the attempt on Tammy. The 15th of October, he was at Chad's from 1:41 to 1:56 p.m. And then the 18th, the night before she dies, we know he was in that LDS parking lot, church parking lot from 2.6 miles away. Mr. Thomas was up with Cross. He, of course, goes into training and education. And then Mr. Thomas brings up Ian Pawlowski. The witness interacted with Ian over the course of a month when Ian had that listening device. So he would get that little USB drive that had the conversations and give that to Detective Hermosillo so that he could extract the contents of those conversations. So then he starts getting into the phone pings and asks, things being out of the ordinary for Alex on key dates. He asks, how long do you look back to see what constitutes a pattern? And the witness says, well, if you see something daily for a week, you'd say that's a pattern. With Alex, they didn't see many patterns because he didn't have a job and his movements were just kind of random and he didn't have anywhere dedicated every day that he had to be. The witness said he saw in September from when it first appeared in Idaho, it went into Lori's apartment in the middle of the night just on those key dates. There were other devices being looked at, but it did not have the extent of information as this particular phone did. Mr. Thomas points out all this is about Alex and not Lori, and the witness says he just looked at Alex's pings. Mr. Thomas mentions the mapping of GPS data and wants to know the software. The witness says a CAST team member was the one putting the data into the software and not him. And the images we saw today came from that mapping software. So Mr. Thomas asked the witness if he put the data into a second software to confirm that the first pings were right. And he says, that's not what I do. Mr. Thomas says, you were the case agent. The buck stops with you and you would have been told. The witness says that the CAST analyst used another software to do his report and it made it look different from the one he had. And that's just kind of how it was. They go to September 23rd, which is the day of JJ's burial, from 9:55 to 10:12 there at Chad's. And Mr. Thomas says, that's not enough time to dig a hole, cut roots, find these stones in the paneling and bury somebody. And the witness says he was there when JJ was found and it would have taken more time to dig that. Totally think Chad had that pre-dug and ready. I think, unfortunately, they just learned lessons from when they murdered Tylee. So on October 9th, that's the attempt on Tammy. He's asked, do you know where Lori was? The witness says she was traveling to Missouri. And then Mr. Thomas asks, on the night Tammy Daybell was murdered, where was Lori? He said either she was in Hawaii or in transit. So on redirect, Lindsay Blake says, you're talking about the device itself. And he says, I can't say at all times Alex had that device personally. Lindsay Blake also brings up 17 minutes wouldn't be enough time for one person to dig a grave. He said, not really. But she said, if more than one were involved, would it be possible? And he said, it could definitely possible with more people or equipment to dig that grave in 17 minutes. He says, I can't say if it was done prior to the device being on the property at the gravesite. And then Dr. Eric Christensen was the next and last witness. He was the medical examiner for the autopsy on Tammy Daybell. In Utah, death certificates are signed off by their staff of 10 forensic pathologists. In Utah, there is no coroner system. And he worked actually in my home state of South Carolina, where we have a coroner system where it's an elected position. He talks about how there's very minimal training when it's an election thing where you could be working at a department store, a grocery store, a restaurant, and you get elected. And then you get to determine after very minimal training whether or not deaths are natural or something more nefarious. He was contacted by Fremont County. He attended when they exhumed Tammy Daybell's body all the way to the medical examiner's office where he performed the autopsy. There's a lot of reasons they will exhume somebody. Maybe DNA wasn't available at the time of somebody's death or the evaluation of criminal circumstances such as Tammy's. There are several reasons. And in his jurisdiction, they spend time before and after gathering information such as medical records, police records, interviews, things that help them understand the circumstances of the death. He kind of gave the example of going to your doctor. You don't just go in and the doctor says, here's what you need. You talk about your symptoms. You try to get a little history so that the doctor can make a good determination of what you need. So exhuming a body is not a common occurrence. At the autopsy, a trainee who is now a pathologist was present, autopsy staff who assisted in taking photos and samples, Lieutenant Powell and others were in attendance. If the body is exhumed, it changes how he performs an autopsy. She was embalmed, which changes the nature of your tissue. It fixes the tissue, but at the same time, it also preserves the tissue. It's difficult due to the stiffness of the body and the tissue, but it's not impossible. The vault that Tammy was in was dry and it had been well maintained with no water damage, which can happen. Her embalming was done very well and recently, which helped with the autopsy, there was some mold growth on her body. So he explains the autopsy process of collecting samples, the external, the internal exam. They take a picture with clothing, then without, then before cleaning, and then after cleaning, they collect trace evidence. They look at the entire body inside out to look for any kind of disease process or to collect samples. And sometimes they will do a layered neck dissection looking for any evidence of injury like strangulation. They don't do this all the time, but if the situation warrants it, then they will. They'll look at samples under the microscope because some organs at eye level look fine, but on a microscopic level, you may see evidence of a disease process just having that closer look. So on Tammy, they concluded she died by asphyxiation and it was a homicide. There are five options for cause of death. One is natural. Number two is suicide. Number three is an accident. Number four is a homicide. And number five is undetermined. So he just explains to the jury, asphyxiation is just being deprived of oxygen and it's a broad category. It could be from a drowning. It could be from a hanging, smothering chemicals such as carbon monoxide poisoning. There were no external injuries that would cause her death. And asphyxia is a diagnosis of exclusion. So if it's a negative autopsy and all the major organs look fine and there's no evidence this death was caused by a disease process or injury, that's essentially why they gave this asphyxiation diagnosis as a cause of death. Seizures can cause asphyxia. Now, Tammy had no history, but it was relayed she may have had some in the days prior to her death. He said it's rare that she would develop them at her age. Usually it's like a youth or young adult onset if you're not born with like a seizure disorder. Arrhythmia disorders in the heart can cause sudden death or inherited disorders related to the heart, but people usually have a family history they're aware of. And again, it's unusual that it just pops up at her age and it presents in childhood or young adulthood with the heart issues. Now, there are many ways somebody can be asphyxiated, smothering, pressing of the neck, chest compression. If you block their ability to breathe by blocking the nose and the mouth, that can cause unconsciousness in 10 to 15 seconds, but it takes the heart a little longer to stop beating and it can beat for a little while after that. Toxicology also can cause sudden death. They look for pesticides. They look for chemical agents. Her toxicology showed therapeutic levels of prescription medication she had taken for many years. And in addition to no abnormal organs or pathological process, she did have bruises. So when they're looking at seizure disorder, they'll look for injuries on the tongue from seizures, incontinence. He calls them soft signs that are not a slam dunk that a seizure has occurred, but sometimes those things are present. There was no evidence of any seizures outside of what Chad told them. He also reviewed medical records for Tammy and saw nothing indicating that she would be even at risk for seizures. And he wouldn't expect a sudden onset of heart issues resulting in her death. They can sometimes tell when someone has died from an intoxicant. Opiates, for example, can slow or stop your breathing. And pulmonary edema is a buildup of fluid in the lungs and it can come out of the body, such as the nose or the mouth area. And he says you can't test for every possible substance somebody could have been poisoned with. The lab they used does a very broad screening for hundreds of very common illicit over-the-counter prescription medications. They also look for heavy metals, pesticides, any kind of nerve agents. None of that was found. She had clean toxicology, essentially. They did a lot more testing on her than most cases, but it was negative except for those therapeutic levels. And actually, two different labs tested her samples. He said it's one of the most extensive toxicology cases he's done just due to the circumstances of her death. The optimal way to test toxicology is through the blood, but since she had been embalmed and buried, there was no blood. So in that case, they'll use liver samples because he said that is one organ that is great for postmortem testing. If you remember, that's also how they tested JJ's toxicology. The embalming doesn't inhibit toxicology testing, but it can slow it down, and it does, and it did. So they show some photos of Tammy in the bed with the foam coming out. I did not get to see that Friday. It was just so sad to see her in that shape. So pulmonary edema, froth comes from the lungs and out of the nose of the mouth. By the way, Lori didn't look at these photos. Kathy said on Friday she did, but today she did not. However, pulmonary edema is not a cause of death. It's a manifestation of an underlying cause, an overdose, a drowning, asphyxia. This played a part in his diagnosis of death by asphyxiation. And he also noted she had a lot of bruises that were kind of missed, and it could have been an indication she was restrained. So he brings up this chart. I'm going to put this here on YouTube for you guys. So if you're looking at this, you are looking at it as if this is somebody lying on their back. So what actually looks to be the left arm for you is actually her right arm. And I did my own little rough diagram of where these bruises were. So you can see that here. The left front bicep and collarbone area had bruises. And then on the front side, on the right, three on the upper arm, and then one on the forearm. Then on the back, she had two bruises on the back of the arm behind the tricep area, and also two on the back of the forearm. So she had a lot of bruises. There was no bruising on the lower body. So they showed us the bruising that was of the photos of the bruising that they took at autopsy. Some of them they did not show us, although they showed us the close-ups. But these were when they were taking the skin samples to see if there was hemorrhage underneath the skin, which can kind of tell the medical examiner how fresh those bruises were. And it shows, taking those samples can show the injury progression. Hemorrhaging is the initial stage. All the bruising showed up, only hemorrhage, which meant they were pretty close to right before she was killed. Once circulation stops, you don't hemorrhage. So in all the samples, he was pointing out, normally you have subcutaneous fat under your skin and it's yellow. You can see the darkness underneath the skin where it had bled. So that told him there was no inflammatory process starting. This was just in the initial stages of bruising. And to me, it did look like fingerprints on that screen. It's just so sad, that poor, poor woman. He noticed lividity, which is a normal post-mortem change where after circulation ceases, the blood settles in the lowest portion of the body because of gravity. It starts about 60 to 90 minutes after death. He says if the person who is deceased lays on their back a couple of hours and were rolled over, within a couple of hours, that blood might redistribute to the front side. But over time, let's say 12 hours instead of two, it's not going to move anymore because it's fixed. That lividity is fixed. The blood has settled, is set. Shortly after death, lividity can go away entirely if you're moved, but as time passes, not so much. So then he now explains rigor mortis, which is stiffening over time. It's fully developed 12 hours after death, and you will stay stiff until decomposition begins. Lividity, rigor mortis, and body temperature can help narrow a window for a time of death, but the longer someone is dead, it's hard to get a time of death. Now, her death was reported just before 6 a.m., and she was described as being stiff and cold. That told him, and there's an objection which was sustained, because he wasn't there the morning of her death, so he would have to rely on somebody else's report to finish this up. So he said he relies on other people's observations to determine a timeline of when the death occurred. With rigor mortis, that's at least an hour or two at minimum and longer, most likely that they've been dead. So he does not think that she died around 5:30, 5:45, but earlier. The bruises played into his cause of death since it's consistent to being restrained. And Lindsay Blake was finished with direct. They showed the jury the few photos they didn't show us. And then that was the end of the day. So I believe tomorrow he will be up on cross-exam, and then we will see what's going on. I thought when they got into Ian, maybe we're setting up for Melanice. Now, I think maybe by the end of this week, we're going to be wrapping up. I think we're going to be having closings as early as the beginning of next week. So we're getting there, y'all, and we're getting through. Now, here's what I'm waiting for. What caused them to charge Lori with conspiracy to commit murder for Tammy Daybell? Because there's got to be something, right? So I think we're going to start seeing some text messages come out between Lori and Chad, maybe even Alex. We don't know. That's got to come in to explain those charges. But if you do stock of why we're here, and really if they laid this whole case out, it would take months. It'd be a 6-month trial. So I think the prosecution's done an amazing job of giving bite-sized pieces to this jury for this very convoluted story for them to be able to digest what they're hearing and put it into a kind of a big picture. And the defense, you know, they're doing the best they can too. I mean, they don't have a whole lot to work with. Lori did not want to use mental health as a defense. She wanted a speedy trial, and here we are. So anyways, that's it for today. If you're on YouTube and you haven't subscribed, please subscribe, because I'm starting to look at my stats and I'm getting a lot of new viewers. The more subscribers I get, the more they push my channel out to people who like true crime. So it helps me grow, and I really appreciate you guys. And it's one easy little thing you can do to help the channel. And so, yeah. All right, guys, we'll see you tomorrow. Hope you have a great one.